Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Leslie Hazelton, Middle East reporter for such publications as Time Magazine, The New York Times, The New York Review of Books, and Harper's Magazine, and author of The First Muslim and After the Prophet. She'll speak on the topic Sunni and Shia, What It Really Means. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Saturday evening, September 28, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Center for Faith Studies, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Margaret McGrath, former interim director of the Center for Faith Studies.
Drawing on Ms. Hazelton's 13 years as a journalist based in Jerusalem, writing for publications including Time, The New York Times, The New York Review of Books, and Harper's, tonight the Center for Faith Studies begins a series devoted to exploring the theme of reconciliation within and among individuals, communities, and the complex, wonderful, and conflicted world we live in. The issues we face today are rooted in the distant and not-so-distant past. Reconciliation flowers when we understand the intricately woven threads of history, culture, and faith, enabling us to bridge the gaps that divide us. We are so very grateful for your presence as we begin this conversation around the mysterious and crucial concept of reconciliation. Please help me welcome Ms. Leslie Hazelton to the podium.
Okay, what's been on my mind recently, especially when it comes to questions such as the split between Shia and Sunni in Islam, is this. How do we live in the present with the past? And it's a particularly cogent question for the Middle East. I mean, here we are in the United States, where we have a relatively short-term concept of history compared to the Middle East. The Middle East is a place where you can sit, literally sit on the lintel of a 3,000-year-old house in Jerusalem. There's nothing else left of the house, but there is that doorstep of the house. The Middle East is a place where you can go out into the desert and you can see geological time. You can see what seems to be the most permanent thing there is, which is rock, move. You can follow the motion of the rock over hundreds of millions of years as it folds in on itself, as it rises up out of the earth, and it makes these extraordinary shapes. And you have, inevitably, if you live in the Middle East, and especially if you live in the deserts of the Middle East, you have a different sense of time. You trace yourself much further into the past. And this, what I'm going to be talking about tonight, is a story of the past. Now, I would use the word history, except I know that the moment I use the word history, everyone's thinking, oh, those history lessons at school, you know, the dates, this, having to memorize, and it's dry as dust, right? Because it's told, usually, without the most essential part of it. Take off the first two letters of history and what you have. Story. And that's what it is. It's our story. It's the story of our past. It's the story of who we are. It's the story of how we got here. And nowhere are those stories more vital, more essential than in the Middle East. It's a Middle Eastern story that brings us all together here. It's Middle Eastern stories that are behind all three of the Abrahamic religions. These are desert religions in origin. They began in this place of seemingly endless time, beyond human time. What we're dealing with here with the Shia-Sunni split is a story that, a crisis, an epic story, and I use the word epic advisedly, that took place 1,400 years ago. But in the Middle East, whereas there is a different concept of history. In the Middle East, which is the one place in the world that seems to have the longest history, the oldest recorded history, the irony is that in a sense, there is no such thing as history. Because the past is never done with. The past is never over. The past is in the present. So what happened 1400 years ago in people's hearts and minds is very often as real and as live as if it had happened yesterday. In other words, what I'm saying is that the whole approach to history, the way people think of history in the Middle East, is totally different. It's alive. There is no such thing, in a sense, as the past. It's all present. How do we live with this? When it comes to the Shia-Sunni split, it's a particular problem because in the West, it's usually told as what I call a nutshell. And I hate nutshells. Okay, what do I mean by a nutshell? Take a pecan nut, right? And it's all nice and smooth and shiny on the outside. And sort of it's a perfect oval, almost, right? Well, it's a spherical oval, whatever. And you could think, okay, well, that's a pecan. That's what a pecan looks like, all nice and smooth and shiny. But if you think that's a pecan, you'll never know what the meat of a pecan is like. You'll never know what it tastes like. You'll never know the essence of the pecan because all you're doing is looking at the shell. And this is what we tend to do with other cultures, other stories. Imagine, for instance, if someone who had never ever knew hardly anything about Christianity were to dismissively describe the basic Christ story as, oh, some guy got stuck up on a cross. It's insulting, isn't it? That dismissiveness. And yet I have heard the Sunni-Shia split being described as some squabble about the succession to Muhammad. So what happened was that in March 2004, I was sitting with a friend, and we had just heard the news about what had just happened in Karbala, in Iraq. And Karbala is one of the two holy cities of Iraq, two Shia Muslims. And what had happened that morning was a concerted series of suicide bombings and mortar attacks on Shia by Sunni. And the question that came up that evening was, how come? How come Muhammad, the prophet of unity, one God and one united people of Arabia, could have left behind him, apparently at the moment of his death in the year 632, what became the seemingly unending, blood-soaked legacy of division? And this question haunted me. It haunted me so much that I decided to spend the next few years going into it because all I had was this nutshell, which was, no, this can't possibly be it. It has to be something so much more than this. And that's when I discovered I went back to the earliest Islamic histories. And that's when I discovered the extraordinary richness of this story, this truly epic story. It's multi-generational. It goes over three generations from Muhammad two generations down to his grandson, Hussein. It involves names that, you know, when you say Ali here, people think of Muhammad Ali. When you say Hussein, they think of Saddam Hussein. But the original Ali, the original Hussein, was something else altogether. We'll get to that. It's a story that involves issues, as you might expect, that go very, very deep to the roots of human existence and society. It involves issues of pragmatism versus idealism, very, very strongly. It involves issues of loyalty versus betrayal. It involves issues of faith and politics and the huge and vast and volatile arena in which they intersect and interact. And it's still very much alive today. In Iraq, which is where the story took place, in Iraq, where almost 5,000 people have been killed in suicide bombings and terror attacks, Sunni on Shia, Shia on Sunni, since June of this year. So I would love to be able to tell you I would not. I am not even going to try to give you the nutshell, because there's no way to do justice to the story this way. All I can tell you is that it is so vivid, it involves such vivid personalities that if you take a Gabriel Garcia Marquez, like the 100 Years of Solitude, that seems simplistic by comparison. He would have gone green with envy if he'd known this story. It is at the core of the story, however, is the extraordinary fear of what was known as fitna, which means division, divisiveness, conflict, which was the one thing that Muhammad devoted his life after he received the first revelation, once he became a prophet, to abolishing within Arabia, of bringing all the tribes together under the umbrella of Islam, under the banner of Allah, the one God. And Allah, of course, simply means the God, the High One. So how did it happen? The source of it, you might say, is that Muhammad died without a son. I know this sounds sexist and so on, but we're talking about 7th century Arabia. If Muhammad had had a son who survived, there was one son who died in infancy, which was very, very common at the time. If Muhammad had had a son, perhaps all this would never have happened. Perhaps it would have been just obvious who would succeed him as the leader of this newly united Arabia after his death. Perhaps if it had taken place a century earlier, it wouldn't even have mattered so much. But it mattered because in the 7th century, Arabia was being united at precisely the time that north of it, the Byzantine Empire to the west and the Persian Empire to the east had fought themselves after 800 years to exhaustion, creating a vacuum of power to the north of Arabia, which is how come you then had what they call the Muslim conquest, which took place mainly, by the way, without any swords at all. There was simply a vacuum of power, and this newly united body out of Arabia just took over, was empowered. If it had been a century earlier, it wouldn't have happened. And where the Byzantine Empire and the Persian Empire had clashed most severely was in Iraq. Iraq, it's today Iraq, it was even then called Iraq, the land between the two rivers, was where they abutted each other and where they fought most. So what happened? The Shia today are 20% of all Muslims. So you think, okay, why all the fuss? Just 20%, they're the minority. But the Shia are also the majority wherever there is the most oil. Iran, Iraq, and the east coast of Arabia itself. And, of course, the whole conflict is being used, with Iran trying to establish itself as the leader of Shia Islam and Saudi Arabia establishing itself as the leader of a particularly conservative kind of Sunni Islam. So this goes so deep that it can always be used. But let's get back to the actual story. Fitna, division, the one thing everybody is most determined to avoid, the one thing everybody fears most, is the one thing that they bring about. This is an absolutely human, tragic story. It has the inevitability of Greek tragedy, played out on a much larger scale, on a much larger stage, with many more actors. So, no son. Muhammad had four daughters with his first wife, Khadija. And this first wife was a loving, caring, monogamous marriage that lasted 24 years until her death. This you probably don't hear about. You hear about him as this lecherous polygamist and so on. What about all the other wives? He married 9 other wives in late life in his 50s after Khadija's death, and all of those were diplomatic marriages of the kind that any leader at the time made. But what is absolutely clear when you go back to the earlier sources, to the early histories, the early Islamic histories, is that Muhammad mourned Khadija until the day of his own death. She was the one woman he truly loved. And she was the only woman with whom he had children. 4 daughters and 1 son who died in infancy. All the other wives he married, only one of them was a virgin when he married her. All the others were widows and divorcees. All of them had children from previous marriages. Not one of them became pregnant by him. The conservative interpretation of this is that this was the price that he had to pay for prophethood, that he would not have the basic human satisfaction of more children, that this was what it cost, that he would be, as they say, abta, cut off in the sense of male progeny. But it meant that when he died, it was not clear who was going to take over. Now, the Shia will bring over, and I've covered this in the books, I'm not going to even try to nutshell it now, say that he wanted Ali to be his successor, his khalifa, thus the English word caliph. That he wanted Ali to be his khalifa and had said so, but not in quite so many words. Ali was his cousin and also his son-in-law. Ali had married his favorite daughter, Fatima. In fact, Muhammad himself had married them. The Sunni argument is varied. Either that he wanted Abu Bakr, who was the father of the one virgin that Muhammad married in later life, Aisha, who did in fact become the first caliph. Or there is a saying that he said this, but this is a much later saying. It's not there in the earliest sources. And the saying is, my community, the ummah, the people, the community that he'd created, the Islamic community, my community will never agree in error. Which sounds like a wonderful thing to say. You're all right, right? Except it wasn't intended that way, and it wasn't taken that way by those who propagated this saying. What they meant was that if you do not agree, then you are not part of the community. Thus we have the essential split here is between the followers of Ali, Shi'at Ali in Arabic, the followers of Ali or the party of Ali, and those, a name that later came into being, who called themselves Sunnis because they followed the Sunnah, the tradition of the majority. This played out over 50 years in the following way. There were 4 caliphs in the years immediately after Muhammad's death. Abu Bakr, one of his fathers-in-law, right? Omar, another of his fathers-in-law, who was a great warrior and led most of the conquest. The conquest did involve 2 huge battles, one against the Persians, one against the Byzantines. Otherwise, it was relatively peaceful. And then 2 of his sons-in-law. Uthman was the 3rd caliph and Ali the 4th caliph. But there were those who said, and the Shi'at Ali said, that Ali was supposed to be the 1st caliph, and they refused to recognize any of the caliphs. In fact, they refused to recognize the caliphate and referred to Ali as the 1st imam. Not imam in the sense of the regular leader of prayer in a mosque, but imam with a capital I. Ali finally became the 4th caliph and was assassinated after just 5 years. He was assassinated by the Kharijis. And the Kharijis were people for whom he was not orthodox enough. He was not... Basically, they were the early fundamentalists, the early violent extremist fundamentalists, who said that he had no right to decide for them about anything at all, Judgment, they said, belongs to God alone, and thus did what fundamentalists still do today. In the name of God, they abrogate the judgment unto themselves and carry out what they think is the judgment of God. In other words, they act as though they were God. And this is the true obscenity of violent fundamentalism and violent extremism in God's name. Ali was assassinated, and a wonderful character called Muawiyah takes over. Muawiyah becomes the fifth caliph. And he's a wonderful, wily, Byzantine kind of politician who has no interest whatsoever in the whole religious side of it. And he takes over, and basically, you can't say that he heals the fitna, he represses it by wile and by force. Meanwhile, Ali's son, Ali has two sons, Hassan and Hussein. Hassan is poisoned. Nobody's quite sure who by. And we come to Hussein. Ali, and the question now is, who will rule? Who will rule what is by now a huge Muslim empire? And the empire was ruled not from Arabia, but from Iraq. Because that is where the movement grew out of. The power was centered in Iraq. Of all places in Iraq is where the Shia-Sunni split became engraved in stone, as it were. Muawiyah established the first Sunni dynasty in Damascus, which would later move to Baghdad. Ali was assassinated. And then 19 years after Ali's assassination, the Iraqis rise up in rebellion against Muawiyah's son Yazid. And they call to Hussein, who's at the time still living in Mecca, to come and lead them and reclaim the leadership of Islam. And it seems like a useless proposition. Muawiyah is incredibly strong. And Hussein goes. So I will read you a little bit now about what happened when he left, when he went, and what led to this decision. And this whole story is why. It centers around why. Why did they do this? The divisiveness that was now taking very, very clear shape had begun even before Muhammad died. It began in all kinds of personal resentments of those around him, as you might expect around a powerful leader. Everybody arguing about who was closest to him, who knew what he really wanted, who was to succeed him, and so on. So the divisiveness that had begun with Muhammad's death and then taken shape around the figure of Ali had now reached into the third generation. And I'm going to read you this because rather than tell you about the story, I want to give you a taste of the meat inside the nut. So it's all I can do right now. Just give you a taste of it, the feel for it. And here it was to harden into a sense of the most terrible wrong, a wrong so deeply felt that it would cut through the body of Islam for centuries to come, with still no end in sight. Hussein, and Hussein, Muhammad loved these two grandchildren, Hassan and Hussein, used to dandle them on his lap, used to sort of, you know, go down on all fours and let them ride horsey on him and so on. Hussein was by now in his mid-50s, and it showed. His beard must have been at least flecked with white, his eyes and mouth etched round with deep lines, yet the posters that today flood Iraqi and Iranian markets show an extraordinarily handsome man in his early 20s. Long black hair cascades down his shoulders. His beard is full and soft, not a grey hair to be seen. His face is unlined, glowing with youth, and his dark eyes are soft but determined, sad and yet confident, as though they were seeing all the joy and all the misery in the world. In the West, the posters are often mistaken, for those few who see them, for somewhat more muscular images of Jesus. And indeed, the resemblance is striking. If Ali was the foundation figure of Shia Islam, Hussein was to become its sacrificial icon. The story of what happened to him once he reached Iraq would become the passion story of Shiism, its emotional and spiritual core. Yet as Hussein's caravan threaded its way out of Mecca, out of the mountains and onto the high desert, a dispassionate observer might have taken one look and thought he was almost destined to fail. If his aim was to reclaim the caliphate from Muawiyah's son, this small group seemed pitifully inadequate to the task. The line of camels traveled slowly, for they carried the women and children of his family, with only 72 armed warriors for protection and just a few horses tied to the camels by their reins. Yet the group rode with assurance, confident that once they arrived, the whole of Iraq would rise up under their banner. And at first that confidence had seemed justified. Letter after letter had been carried across the 800 miles between Kufa, the city that had risen up against Muawiyah's son Yazid, between Kufa and Mecca in the weeks since Muawiyah had died and his son Yazid had succeeded to the throne in Damascus. So many letters that they filled two large saddlebags, and all of them from the Shi'at Ali, the Shia, the followers of Ali. "Speed to us, Hussein," they urged. This is in the earliest sources, these quotes. "The people are waiting for you and think of none but you. Claim your rightful place as the true heir of the Prophet, his grandson, his flesh and blood through Fatima, your mother. Bring power back where it belongs, to Iraq. We will drive out the Syrians, Muawiyah and his son, under your banner. We will reclaim the soul of Islam." The pivotal message was the one that came from Hussein's cousin, Muslim, whom he'd sent to Iraq to confirm that they were indeed committed to his leadership. "I have 12,000 men ready to rise up under you," Muslim wrote. "Come now, come to an army that has gathered for you." And so Hussein went. But what he didn't know was that the rebellion was already over before he'd even left Mecca. Muslim had been crucified. Yes, crucified, because crucifixion was used, as you know, throughout the Roman world and also throughout the Middle East at the time. In fact, it wasn't even the Romans who introduced it. It was the Assyrians, about 1,000 years BC. And it was the standard punishment for treason of any kind, or acting against the established powers that be. So Hussein was already on his way. He was halfway to Iraq when he got the news that he should turn back, that the rebellion was over, that there was nothing to go forward for. And he refused to turn back. He said, "Man journeys in darkness and his destiny journeys towards him." And he went on with the women, with the children, with just 72 warriors, to what he had to have known would be his death, and their deaths too. In a sense, you know, there's something here very reminiscent of Jesus in Jerusalem, who had to have known when he caused that scene in the temple what the upshot of it would be, who had to have known that with his message of social justice, it was a subversive political message, and there was only one possible result, and that would be crucifixion. In other words, it was a knowing self-sacrifice. And this is what is attributed also to Hussein. He was stopped by one of the Iraqi governor's cavalry units just outside the city of Kufa, where his father had been buried, and given a choice. Either he should agree to come to Kufa, in Iraq, still, under arrest and pledge allegiance to Yazid as the sixth caliph, the son of Muawiyah, or he should turn back to Mecca So he turned north. And this is what happened. He led his small caravan along the desert bluff overlooking the immense flat valley formed by the Euphrates and the Tigris. And the cavalry detachment rode alongside, more like an escort than an enemy. At dusk, with the women and children tired and thirsty, Hussein gave the order to pitch their tents just below the bluff, within sight of fields and orchards watered by a branch of the Euphrates. It was Wednesday, the first day of the Muslim month of Muharram, and he'd travel no further. By the third day of Muharram, the small encampment had been surrounded by an army. When news reached the governor that Hussein had been allowed to travel north instead of being arrested, he'd sent no fewer than 4,000 cavalry and archers out from Kufa under the command of a notoriously ruthless general by the name of Shimr, a name destined to live on in the Shia annals of infamy alongside Muawiyah, Yazid, and Ubaidallah, the governor. Shimr's orders were clear. He was to place Hussein's encampment under siege, cutting it off from all access to the river. In the terrible, stifling heat, he was to allow not one drop of water through the lines. Thirst would bring Hussein to his knees. As both the survivors and the besiegers told their memories of the next 7 days, they would unfold as an almost stately series of events, as though the story were playing itself out on a stage far larger than this desolate patch of sand and stone. Even as they spoke, the people who told the story seemed aware of how sacred it would be, of how history would loose the bonds of gravity and soar into legend. While Shimon and his 4,000 men waited for thirst to do its work, undying memories were created. One by one, the iconic images of Shiism were brought into being. There was Hussein's nephew Qasim, who married his cousin, Hussein's daughter. This was very common at the time, to marry one's cousin, in that beleaguered encampment. And even as they all knew what was to come, they celebrated life over death, the future over the present. But the marriage was never consummated. No sooner was the ceremony over than Qasim demanded that he be allowed to go out to engage the enemy in single combat. It was his wedding day, and he was not to be denied. Still in his embroidered wedding tunic, he stepped out from the tents towards Shimr's lines. There were 10 of us in that sector, all on horseback, one of Shimr's men remembered. And a young man all in white came towards us with a sword in his hand. Our horses were circling and prancing, and he was nervous, turning his head this way and that. I saw 2 pearls swinging from his ears as he moved. They didn't swing for long, because the newly made groom was cut down, and all the promise of a wedding day snuffed out. Then there was Abbas, Hussein's half-brother, who wore 2 white egret's plumes atop his chainmail helmet, a distinction awarded only the bravest warrior. Driven by the parched cries of the children as the small encampment ran out of water, he made his way through the enemy lines at night and filled a goatskin at the river, only to be ambushed on the way back. One man against many, he fought, and the sword that pierced his heart, he fought until one of his arms was cut off, at which he grabbed the goatskin full of water between his teeth, apparently went on fighting, and the sword that pierced his heart also pierced the goatskin, and the water ran red with his blood as it spilled out onto the sandy soil. And there was Hussein's eldest son, Ali Akbar. He was on the brink of adulthood, fresh-faced youth. Yet he too insisted on going out to do single combat, determined to die fighting rather than of thirst. A lad came out against us with a face like the first splinter of the moon, said one of those who crowded in on him. One of his sandals had a broken strap, the left one, I think. When Ali Akbar was killed, they say that Hussein swooped down like a hawk to cradle his dying son. And that is how the two are still shown in posters that you can find in both Iraq and Iran, wherever there are Shia. A famed pose deliberately mirrored in other posters showing Muqtada al-Sadr, the leader of the Mahdi army in Iraq, cradling the body of his father, the revered cleric Muhammad Sadiq al-Sadr, who, along with his two older sons, was murdered by Saddam Hussein's thugs in 1998. But perhaps the most iconic image of all was that of Hussein's infant son. Just 3 months old, he was so weak from dehydration that he could no longer even cry. Hussein himself, despairing, came out in front of the tents and held the infant up in his arms for all the enemy to see. His voice cracked and parched with thirst. He begged Shimmer's men to have mercy on these children, to allow water at least for them. The reply was an arrow shot straight into the neck of the infant, even as he lay in Hussein's outstretched hands. And then came the eve of the final day, Ashura, the 10th of the month of Muharram, the setting for the Shia equivalent of the Last Supper. Hussein begged those of his men who still survived to leave him to his fate. "All of you," he said, "I hereby absolve you from your oath of allegiance to me and place no obligation upon you. Go home now under cover of darkness. Use the night as a camel to ride away upon. These men of Yazid's want only me. I beg you, leave for your homes and for your families." And of course they stayed. Mouths parched, which mine is right now. Lips swollen, voices harsh and rasping with thirst, they swore never to leave him. "By God," said one, "if I knew that I was to be burned alive and my ashes scattered and then revived to have it done to me again 1,000 times, I still would never leave you. How then could I leave you when what I now face is a matter of dying only once?" "Then call upon God and seek forgiveness," said Hussein, "for our final day will come tomorrow." And then he used the Islamic phrase uttered in the face of death. "We belong to God, and to God we shall return." That last night was spent in prayer and preparation. Hussein took off his chainmail and put on a simple white seamless robe, a shroud. He had myrrh melted in a bowl and anointed himself and his men with the perfume, and all of them knew that they were being anointed, as corpses are, for death. "Tears choked me and I pushed them back," one of Hussein's daughters would remember. The women were not killed. "I kept silent and knew that the final tribulation had come upon us." And this is how the city of Karbala got its name, that would be built on this spot. Karbala means the place of trial and tribulation. And it is today the second holy city of Shia Islam, the first one being Kufa, where Hussein's father Ali was buried. Actually, it's Najaf, which is just outside Kufa, and Kufa is now part of Najaf. Tears are infectious, almost physically so. Whether in a movie house or in real life, people fight back tears of sympathy and then find that their vision is blurred and the fight's already been lost. In the 10 days leading up to Ashura, every detail of Hussein's ordeal at Karbala is recalled and reenacted. The story so central to Shia Islam has been kept alive year after year, century after century, not in holy writ, but by the impassioned force of memory, of repetition and reenactment. A vast cycle of tazia, or passion plays, is staged every year, so many of them in so many places that the Oberammergau cycle of medieval Christianity is a pale mirror by comparison. The pacing is almost stately. The dialogue more a series of speeches than a give and take, but no Broadway or West End performance has ever had more rapt an audience. Every appearance on stage of a black-robed Yazid or Ubaidallah or Shimmer is greeted by hisses and boos. The newlywed groom about to bid farewell to a still virgin bride before going to his death is acclaimed with tears. As Hussein Hilza holds up his infant son in front of the enemy, people beat their breasts and wail softly, almost to themselves, as though if they could stifle their sobs, the tragedy could somehow still be averted. But the height of these plays, the most intense points, comes not when Hussein is actually killed, but at the moment he dons his white shroud. For all the terrible pathos of what has already happened, this moment, one of the least dramatic to Western eyes, is the most unbearable for the audience. It's the moment of calm in the face of death, the willing acceptance of the call to self-sacrifice. For 10 days, the commemoration of Ashura has been leading up to this moment. Men have gathered in Husseiniya, Hussein houses, special halls set aside specifically for telling the story of Karbala, for tears and reflection, grief and meditation. Women have crowded into one another's homes to build the wedding canopy for Hussein's daughter and his nephew Qasim, then decorate it with silk ribbons and strew petals on the floor, creating a marriage bed for the union that'll never take place. They stretch another smaller canopy over a cradle and fill it with offerings for Hussein's infant son, candies and toys. They implore Hussein to intercede for them and their children in their 21st century lives, to keep them safe from drugs and violence and all of life's other temptations and dangers. And they mourn, beating their breasts and slapping their cheeks faster and faster as the chanting picks up pace. Hussein, 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 until they've no strength left. And everything culminates on the 10th day, Ashura the 10th, the day of the processions. Men and boys march by the hundreds in the villages, by the thousands and tens of thousands in the cities. Whole squadrons of men beat their chests in union, their hands clenched into hollow fists, the better to reverberate against the ribcage. And with each step, each blow, Ya Hussein, O Hussein. The echoing thud of one man striking himself this way is sobering. The sound of thousands can be heard miles away, as loud as the tolling of a cathedral bell at Easter, and far more terrifying for the knowledge that this is the sound of flesh on flesh. Throughout the procession, people carry posters blown up large, garlanded with flowers and with green and black silk banners, green for Islam, black for mourning. Some of the standard ones of Hussein, his kafir falling in graceful folds to his shoulders, but others are specifically for Ashura, and these show his bare head angled back, blood on his forehead, and his mouth open in agony. The head seems to float in space, and in a way it does. It is severed, and it's speared on the point of a lance. This is the moment with Hussein's death that what the Sunnis consider history becomes for Shia sacred history, and the aura of sacredness permeates everything around it. There's no mention in the early accounts, in the early histories, of Hussein's three-year-old daughter, Sukaina, roaming the battlefield. No mention of tears streaming from the eyes of his white horse or of the sudden appearance of two white doves who flew off and flew to Mecca. Their arrival, bloodstained, would announce the news. But who can hold that against the millions of Shia for whom Ashura is what defines them? Details accrue around a story of such depth and magnitude in the Passion of Hussein as in the Passion of Christ. Eventually, they would tell how Lahik, that noblest of all Arab stallions, Hussein's white horse, bowed down and dipped his forehead in his master's blood, then went back to the women's tent, tears streaming from his eyes, and beat his head on the ground in mourning. They would tell how two doves flew down and dipped their wings in Hussein's blood, then flew south first to Medina and then to Mecca, so that when people there saw them, they knew what had happened and the wailing of grief could begin. They would tell how the three-year-old Sukaina wandered out onto the battlefield in search of her father, crying out for him piteously, surrounded by blood-soaked corpses. And with time, it made no difference if Abbas really had fought on with only one arm, with the goatskin clenched in his teeth, or if the horse really did cry, or if the doves really did fly down from heaven. Faith and need said they did. The stories have become as true as the most incontrovertible fact, if not more so, because they have such depth of meaning. As with the death of Christ, the death of Hussein soars beyond history into meta-history. It enters the realm of faith and inspiration, of passion, both emotional and religious. How does one live with a story like this? How does one live with a past like this? I've been told by Sunnis who've read this book that they never knew the story. They never knew these details. They never knew how deep it went. And they have a new compassion for the Shia point of view. But that annual commemoration, that deep sense of a deep injustice, that sense that leadership of Islam belongs to what the Shia called Ahl al-Bayt, the people of the house of Muhammad in the same sense as the house of Windsor, his blood, his closest blood relatives, that is, his cousin and son-in-law Ali, his daughter Fatima, and their children Hassan and Hussein. And here they were just 50 years later, both Ali and Hussein assassinated in the most bloody way possible. How does one live with this? Or does one make pragmatic accommodation, which is, of course, what Muawiyah, the fifth caliph, did, and say, right, just keep it down, folks. We are going to go ahead. This is now a matter of politics and not of faith. How does one make that differentiation between politics and faith in a part of the world where the two are inextricably intertwined, still are? Israel, Palestine, Jews, Arabs, Shia, Sunni, Christian, Muslim. It's you cannot pull these things apart. And you cannot get beyond the past until you acknowledge it. I speak here, my training is as a psychologist before I became a writer and before I got involved in history of religions. The only way to live with the past is to acknowledge it, to acknowledge that it's part of you, it's part of who you are. And if you repress that acknowledgement, then it will haunt you. Then you will never be rid of it. Then it will determine the present, as it is still doing in Iraq and in Iran and in Afghanistan and in Lebanon and in Somalia and most recently in Kenya. A couple of years ago, I heard this wonderful definition of forgiveness. And it plays on, I don't know if you know, what's written above the entrance to hell in Dante's Inferno. It says, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." Somehow I always thought that was written above the entrance to Auschwitz, but of course it wasn't. It should have been, but it wasn't. That was Arbeit macht frei. "But abandon hope, all ye who enter here." That was Dante's motto for hell. So I don't know where this definition of forgiveness began. I don't know who first came up with it, and I've researched, I've tried to find out. I've contacted the guy who told me, and the guy who told him, and the guy who told him, and everybody's heard it from somewhere else. But it is wonderful. And it goes as follows. Forgiveness is abandoning all hope of a perfect past. Abandoning all hope of a perfect past. What should have been 1400 years ago, what should have been yesterday, what should have been this morning, what was wrong then, what was wrong this morning. This idea of perfection is built into fundamentalism. Fundamentalist Muslims, for instance, the Salafis and the Wahhabis, do you hear about? Think of those first 50 years of Islam as perfect. which is very, very hard for any objective observer to quite countenance. The first four caliphs of Islam, two fathers-in-law of Muhammad and two sons-in-law, only one died a natural death, the first one. He died 2 years into his caliphate of old age. That was Abu Bakr. The others, Omar, Uthman, Ali, were all assassinated, two of them by other Muslims. Please tell me, where is the perfection in this? Please tell me that you cannot possibly see this era as one of perfection. It is one of human tragedy. It is one where everybody was trying to avoid division, and yet every step they took one way or another, like Hussein going to Karbala, he just could not be stopped. With all the best intentions, with all the nobility in the world, with all the noble intentions in the world, as I say, it was like a Greek tragedy. It was fated to be, it was inevitable. How do we live with this? We live with this by acknowledging it. We live with this by sharing each other's sorrow over the past, by acknowledging it, by saying yes. We live with it in the same sense as they are learning to live with the past in South Africa, with the Reconciliation Commission. And it's hard and it's difficult to accept that we are just human, that we're all imperfect, that there is no such thing as perfection. And I think that may be one of the things that most distinguishes the vast majority of us from this extremist minority who try to dominate the conversation so much. They insist that they're right in everything. They insist that they know what God wants. They insist on perfection. And it is our job to stand up for being human, for being as good as we can, and praising God for that. Thank you. If you have any questions, if I can, I will answer. And I promise if I do not know the answer, I will say I don't know.
Would you say just a few words about the historical implications of the women that surrounded Muhammad?
Yes.
You talked about his final wife, his early wife, and his daughter.
Yeah, we tend to think of Muslim women as practically in purdah and so on, you know, as hidden away, which in some very conservative countries they are, notably Saudi Arabia. Though, in fact, there's a lot of pretty gutsy Saudi businesswomen out there now who are not veiled, who are, you know, right out there. It's very interesting what's happening there. It's changing. But you go back to Muhammad's time and the women are right out there up front. Khadija we don't hear so much about because she died before he became a leader. But we hear a lot about Aisha, the youngest of the late life wives that he married in his 50s. The daughter of Abu Bakr, who became the first caliph. And in fact, and this is totally amazed me when I read it, it was Aisha who led an army of 10,000 men into battle against Ali when he was caliph. She led an army, mounted on a red camel, which was right in the middle of all the fighting and so on, yelling these, you know, blood-curdling screams and so on, urging her men on, and it was this is not what one expects of a woman in the 7th century Arabia. There are other women, you know, who you can read about in, well, it's in the book, who are just out there in very, very active ways. The veil, for instance. Right. So we think, okay, they were veiled. They weren't. The veil came into being later. It began originally this way. In his 50s, Muhammad by then has 9 wives. Each one has her own room along the one wall of the mosque, or what by then is the central mosque. And of course, there's people coming all the time, right? Constantly. There is no privacy. There's no such thing as a privacy in 7th century Arabia. So, and then one of his wives got jostled, and so she was hurt in the process, and so on. Muhammad said, okay, hang a curtain, a divider, between the two parts of the room. Each one lived in just, you know, one room. It was very, very simple living. So at least there's some modicum of privacy. But this was only for his wives. So they would have just a little bit of privacy there. What happened after his death was that Muhammad's wives were then known as the mothers of the faithful. And this is in the Quran. They would be known as the mothers of the faithful. They were not to marry after his death. They were to be considered the mothers of the whole ummah, the whole people, all Muslims. And therefore, of course, can't marry your mother, right? Which made them the highest status women in the Muslim ummah, people. And therefore, what happened in the years to come is that high status women decided to emulate them. Not by having a curtain, but by having a kind of mini curtain, a veil. And that was the origin of the veil. This developed partly because the high status women decided to emulate what they thought the Prophet's wives were doing. And then, of course, it became institutionalized because then the bearded men took over. As they do, as they did with early Judaism, as they did with early Christianity. So that, apologies to those with beards, and as they did with early Islam. And they brought their own values, which were pre-Islamic. If you read the Quran, you'll be amazed to see that there are whole passages that are extraordinarily egalitarian. They're addressed to believing men and believing women, faithful men and faithful women, specifically singling out women as well. There's anger at the tradition in Mecca of valuing sons over daughters. Anger at it, that this is wrong. The daughters are equal to sons and of equal value as sons and so on. There's extraordinary stuff in there. And in fact, you know, in many ways it's far more egalitarian toward women than anything that's in the Bible. So it's part of what happens when religion gets institutionalized. When it becomes an institution of power, and those who grab the power then start to lay down the dogma. Okay, enough of that. Sorry. I think that's saying it's time for me to stop.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Leslie Hazelton, Middle East reporter for such publications as Time Magazine, The New York Times, The New York Review of Books, and Harper's Magazine, and author of The First Muslim and After the Prophet. She spoke on the topic Sunni and Shia, What It Really Means. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Saturday evening, September 28, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Margaret McGrath, former interim director of the Center for Faith Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.